Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele podcast. We are doing a deep dive into the new book, The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Its author is Washington Post phenom. I love your work at the Post. I've been following it for years. Philip Bump.
Thanks,
and so when we went to break, we were talking about the things that we kind of misconstrue or misunderstand about the baby boom generation, where their power may or may not be centered, the economics, all of that. But there is a generation, in my view, that's giving them a run for the money that and I appreciate the fact that you actually gave me a quote in the book. So I'm really, really happy for that. But we started talking about in the aftermath about the new American politics. Mm-hmm. And my point to you was that Gen Z, millennials, they kind of played the game, but they played the game in a more traditional way. They sort of accepted their parents' view of politics or approach to politics, sort of adhering to some of the traditional systems and the roles and the rules and all of that. Not completely, not 100% for sure, but in large measure. However, Gen Z, their grandchildren, the grandchildren of the baby boomers, and the great-grandchildren have a whole different view of American politics. In the book, you quote me as saying, so I, again, excuse the little pat on the back, but I thank you for it. Quote, these folks are a whole different breed. They don't look at politics the way my generation or your generation did. There's no way. And what I point out to is their activism. They, when you look at, for example, the Parkland shooting in Florida, quote, they weren't defeated by the narrative. They leaned into it and pushed back against it and challenged the state legislature. You're looking at 20-somethings and 30-somethings beginning to run for elective office and heading up organizations and grassroots organizations. How do you think that materializes over the next years? That's going to have a profound impact on public policy, and it's certainly going to have a profound impact on our economy. And they're going to be looking at the people who were weighing down their future, and they don't want to be a part of that. And really, for me, that is how I kind of sum up this generation. They look at the system and they see it as bankrupt. They look at the system and they say, my future is not in that. And so they're about trying to create the system that the baby boomers just talked about, whether it's on gun legislation, abortion, other social issues like LGBTQ, for example.
Right.
Their approach to politics and policy, the economy and culture is very different from what we've seen up to this point. Expand a little bit of that. And you know, I'll give you, and I want to throw in the mix here, the election of Maxwell Frost, Democrat from Florida, first Gen Zer to Congress. That's just the beginning, because a lot of people are like, where did he come from? What, you know, you're supposed to be, you have to wait till you're like 35 or 40 before you do that.
All right. Yeah. So there are a few things here. And you're right. Frost is interesting. There's some other examples of local legislators in the book that I get into. I think one thing that's important to remember here is that the politics of younger generations are often different than the politics of older generations. So you'd mentioned Gen X. Gen X, I'm a member of Gen X. We there weren't a lot of us. And so we sort of trailed along the boomers and played the boomers game to a large extent. Millennials and Gen Z are different, but the politics are different as well. And so when we were talking before the break about the ways in which the baby boom had been successful at its political advocacy, that's true. But now there's a different set of political things that young people are worried about. They're worried about climate change. They're worried about guns. They're worried about LGBTQ issues, none of which were as salient to older generations when they were young as they are now to young people. And so to some extent, this also breeds some intergenerational resentment, because young people say to the older people, why didn't you deal with climate change? Why don't you deal with guns? And the answer, of course, is that A, we weren't as aware of climate change, and B, guns, you know, we had different laws in place that dealt with guns to some extent. These things change, and so that changes the politics. You're right. So, you know, one of the things I did in the book, I don't just take everyone's word for granted. I went and checked out, okay, let's see if this Michael Steele guy knows what he's talking about. And so I spoke with people that did organizing, people who did try and get young people to run for office. And they reflected exactly what you said, which is that, yes, young people are very engaged, surprisingly engaged, and actually vote more heavily at this age than did boomers at the same age, right? That there's a lot more political engagement, in part because they have access to tools which helps them organize a lot, right? So they have access to internet-based tools, for example, which makes it very easy to organize. So the Parkland shooting response, for example, sprung up online. If you'd had to do that using the tools that existed in the 1970s, you would never have gotten the number of protests and rallies that you had around the country. You know, what are you going to do? Take out an ad in the back Rolling Stone, right? Like, you just didn't have the same tool set you have now. And that gives them more of a voice, which again, exacerbates generational tension, because boomers are like, who are all these kids that I see on the news all the time? I don't want to hear from them, because they have the ability to be heard. The question then is, what happens over the long term? We know this is a particularly liberal group of people. Over the long term, our expectation has historically been they're going to get more conservative. Is that going to hold here? One of my arguments in the book is probably not. And the reason is twofold. The first, that the Republican Party will almost necessarily have to pivot away from its current focus on older, whiter Americans as this younger generation comes up. And the Republican Party, it can change its politics. Like, you are very aware of this, right? The GOP can change what it stands for. It tried to do that after 2012, and then Trump sort of submarined it a little bit. But it can change. But the second is, we've never had a group of young Americans who looks like this group of young Americans, right? And so is it the case that young Black Americans now, who are very Democratic, are going to become more conservative as they get older? Well, that hasn't been the pattern with Black Americans in the past. Is that going to hold for Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans? We've never seen as diverse a group of young voters. And so I don't know that we can assume they're also going to become as equivalently conservative as we assume had happened to past generations as well.
Well, you touch on that. You present, I think, some really kind of gnarly questions for me in the book, that I think when people read it, it's going to just cause them to sit back and pause a little bit, particularly when you're talking about this new politics, because, for example, you know, who's going to control the economy? Who's going to control the public policy around the environment? And if you've got this sort of these lines between Gen Zers, millennials, and Gen Xers, right? Because that'll be the new frontier.
Right.
Because we're on the rocking porch at this point. So we're no longer, you know, in the C-suite, the captains of industry. You know, we're seeing already what's happening in Congress, right? Nancy Pelosi and company are traded in for, you know, Hakeem Jeffries and company. Right. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans will catch up to that, although they will argue, and I think correctly, that we've already kind of done that because we're looking at a Kevin McCarthy and Scalise and, sure, you know, God help us, Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, sort of generation of Republicans. So that you see that changing of the guard, if you will. Mm-hmm. So the battle lines are going to be drawn, I think. So I'm curious as to how the millennials and the Gen Xers respond to the politics of the Gen Zers. How did you unravel that mystery?
Yeah, it's interesting because there isn't a lot of data on Gen Z's politics because they're still so young, right? I mean, right, there's only so many Gen Zers that actually can vote at this point. And since most polling is oriented around voters or adults, obviously those things having the same starting point, which, by the way, was made younger for the boomers because there's so many boomers that wanted to vote before they turned 21. So they lowered the voting age.
Right.
But, you know, because Gen Z, there just simply isn't a lot of data. It's hard to say how they compare to millennials. We do see this very, very funny to me and probably to you, intergenerational tension between millennials and Gen Z, where they stake out these very sort of arcane cultural disputes that you and I are like, what the hell are you even mad about?
Yeah,
like,
what are you, right?
What's the distinction you're drawing here? But, you know, I mean, so it's not the case that obviously millennials and Gen Z are just going to, you know, be hand in hand through eternity. Millennials are much, much more democratic than Gen X or than the baby boom or older generations. Gen Z, there's no indication that they're any more conservative than them. And it'll be sort of fascinating to see over time if they stay even more to the left of millennials. And maybe then once the entire system sort of shifts a little bit to the left, as it may, if that makes the millennials then the more conservative generation relative to Gen Z, right? I mean, we could just have this sort of evolving Overton window-y sort of shift in politics over time, which, you know, one could certainly argue we've seen something of that effect in the United States itself. What with, you know, the GOP's position on gay marriage isn't what it was in 2004, for example, right? You know, so I don't know is the answer, in part because we just don't have a lot of good data for Gen Z. But we do see this activism and interest in these political issues that are very, very important political issues and that they have helped elevate, even if they don't have the same level of robust political power that the baby boom generation does. A lot of the issues we talk about today are ones that are particularly salient to young people.
Yeah, you raise that point and you give some examples of sort of the flow of the politics for this emerging class of voters and activists and participants. You give two examples. For example, you talk about Alex Lee, who's the Democratic Socialist state legislator from California, who lives with his parents and worked in a gig economy job to make ends meet while running for office. Then you also had Sarab Sharma, who was the right wing head of an organization centered on getting conservatives ready for public service. And you quote Lee as saying, two decades from now, knowing people in my age range or younger than my age and where their political beliefs are about these range of issues, I will probably be seen. And this is the Democratic Socialist saying this. I will probably be seen as somewhere in the center, which is unfortunate, I think, where I'm seen as an outsider today. That will be mainstream tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah. And that's actually kind of consistent with the ebb and flow of our politics generationally, correct?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, I think that Lee, look, he represents the South Bay area of California. So I feel pretty confident the people he hangs out with are pretty far to the left of the mainstream of American society. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to come to fruition in, you know, Kansas City. But Yes, it is the case that our boundaries for what constitutes liberal and conservative over time, beyond things like government spending, right, which is sort of the you know, should we have more or less government spending, which is sort of the, you know, the line that's often drawn to differentiate those two groups, that's very fungible, and that our sense of what it means to be conservative. I mean, look, you know, women have had the right to vote for 100 years. The liberal position 100 right. years ago was that women should be allowed to vote, for God's sake, right? And now it's just, it's taken for granted. So yes, this, all of this changes and is very fungible. I think Lee raises the point that I was just making, which is, yeah, it may be the case that because these groups are so much to the left of where we are today, that the whole system may simply just shift, and then the millennials move to the center. I think that is, you know, something that a lot of Democrats would be very enthusiastic to hear as a possibility. You know, I'm not entirely sold. I mean, Saurabh Sharma is a very, very conservative person and represents a wing of the Republican Party, which is young people who are agitating in this MAGA-ist way that is, you know, in part about access to power and in part about obviously actual values. And, you know, there's that's a tension that will exist and probably not be resolved in the short term. So I don't think we can automatically say this shift is going to happen to the left, but it certainly is one possibility.
Hey, everybody, thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA, so we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us, the way Americans do, on a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news, weird politics, weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your 2 free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.